You know, I'm kind of dating myself here, but the comedian George Burns said that the secret to a really good sermon is that it have a catchy beginning, a powerful ending, and that the two are very close together. So you're going to be disappointed. You know, my older sister is what some people would call a pagan. She believes, as I do, that nature is alive, that it's far more intelligent than we are, and it's a tangible manifestation of the spiritual force that permeates the universe. Yet, she's regarded askance by many who harbor more traditional religious beliefs. This is nothing new, as we shall see. My sister wonders why people are so eager to worship what they can't see when all about them is God, visible, manifest, incarnate. The sun, the life force, the miracle of birth, the multiplicity of the life forms around us, and the improbable mystery of existence itself. To her, the biblical phrase, "and the word was made flesh," suggests the Creator resides within the creation, not apart from it. While a Wiccan, or what some would call a witch, my sister is essentially a nature mystic, someone who seeks to blend her consciousness and sense of self with the divine power that's incarnate in the creation. And what is a nature mystic? Well, it's a person who, when in rapport with the natural world, is possessed of a full and vibrant soul, someone who has been spiritually sculpted by interactions with nature in ways that transform one's spirit and transcend the self. They are people bonded with the creation so intensely that no matter what befalls them in life, no matter what they lose, nature always provides a sanctuary, a place of worship. Therein, they are as close as they can be to what they consider God. What they know in the depths of their souls is that nature is our primal home. As philosopher Alan Watts reminded us, we don't come into the world, we come out of it, and to it we all return. Deep in our synapses and within the infinitesimally tiny structures of each atom in our bodies, nature is bedrock. It is the whatever it is that we call the life force, a mysterious but discernible energy that permeates the cosmos from massive galaxy to Homo sapiens to minuscule subatomic quark, comprising an incredibly complex matrix that in aggregate functions like an intelligent organism in its own right. Over endless eons that stretch beyond our mental horizons and simply vanish in the abyss of deep time, this force has continually created, destroyed, recreated, and transformed all the structures and processes that constitute our universe, ourselves included. What's more, the force is in each of us. It innervates every atom in our bodies, all of which originated in the fiery cores of ancient stars that exploded billions of years ago. You know, whenever I say the word billions, I think of Carl Sagan. You know, remember him? Billions and billions. Within these incredibly hot furnaces of creation, these stars, the heavy elements that constitute everything that we are and everything we see around us came into being, blasted out into the vast expanse of the cosmos in gigantic explosions called supernova. One of these clouds of life stuff slowly coalesced into our solar system and home planet. We are quite literally children of the stars, of which there are more in our universe than there are grains of sand on planet Earth. Sound impossible? Miracles often do. It just happens that this one has science to back it up. This force that innervates you, me, and everything else is unimaginably powerful and wondrously elusive. As Walt Whitman said, quote, "All things of the universe are miracles, each as profound as any." And among the greatest of these is that in the credo of the nature mystic, the entire cosmos is alive and sentient. From the indescribably tiny to the immensely vast structures and events that make up our material existence, all is alive, comprising a dance of unceasing transformation, birth, life, death, rebirth, and on. And when we go mind open and with soul into the natural world, as we all could have done this morning on this snowy day. It is the miraculous power that we encounter and in which we dwell. It is there, while in the presence of this most elemental and vital of all phenomenon, that we can recognize what is unshakably true in ourselves and in this strange trip called existence. You know, there's the social you, there is the self-reflective you, there is the private you. And then, at the core, there is the essential you, the one that remembers in a diffuse way, but an unconscious one often, what it was like to be outside of time, unfettered by space, and immersed in a unity beyond all things. Some call it the oceanic feeling, others name it cosmic consciousness, or simply the all. No matter the labels, nature can open a door to one's innermost self, to the immutable core of one's being that is unencumbered by the world of people, deadlines, egos, and tasks. It reawakens that part of us that still reverberates with the power of the stars from which we came. This is a truth that Homo sapiens have realized for millennia, long before recorded history. Since the ancients first deified the sun as the source of all life, which on our planet is quite literally true, we humans have understood that there is a force in the natural world far greater than any technology or intelligence in our possession. Genuine power is not in skyscrapers or missiles or social networks or tweets. It is in hurricanes, earthquakes, volcanoes, supernova, quasars, tsunamis, black holes. It is in the birthing of stars, the tenacity of the life force, the verdant fields, galaxies, comets, and the beating hearts of newborns. And while modern folk have largely lost dialogue with this power, it waits for us to open its doors and learn its ways. So, it is within the ways of nature that we can discover a clearer sense of who we are, why we are, and to what we belong. Not an intellectual sense, but a felt one. The roots of nature mysticism are indeed ancient. As Henry Skolonowski, a philosopher at the University of Michigan, put it, quote, "The first act of awe when man was struck with the beauty or wonder of nature was the first spiritual experience. As best we can discern, the earliest pagan religions began sometime before 10,000 BCE, probably during the Paleolithic age. At that time, most humans lived in tribes as nomadic hunter-gatherers who were deeply embedded in the rhythms and workings of the natural world. Their gods were the unfathomable forces that shaped their lives, the sun, the moon, other celestial bodies, the seasons, the animals and plants that afforded them food, clothing, shelter, herbal medicine, and the atmospheric and tectonic forces that reigned over their world and still do our own. It was during this time that the concept of the goddess emerged. Women were recognized as the bearers of new life, and associations were made between their own fertility and that of the life force working through plants and animals and seasonal fluctuations. Deities took on gender characteristics. The sun was often viewed as masculine, while the moon and earth assumed a feminine motif. But in contrast to the male domination so prevalent in many of today's major religions, paganism embraced both aspects, male and female, and often deferred to the goddess, or what Native Americans call our first mother, as the primary deity. Given such humble, harmless, and natural beginnings, how did paganism become viewed with such suspicion and fear, even hatred? For the majority of Americans, the term pagan continues to carry a negative connotation, one associated with demonic forces and superstition and black magic, craven rituals, essentially what Star Wars groupies would call the dark side. This bias represents the lingering presence of a destructive and barbarous period in human history. But its darkness did not emanate from pagans, but from so-called other people of God. The term pagan is from the Latin word paganus, which means rural or of the country. It did not become a derogatory term until the Roman Empire under the rule of Emperor Constantine, who adopted Christianity as a state religion in the 4th century of the modern era, at which point those persons practicing polytheism, or the worship of many gods, including nature deities, were pressured and later persecuted to convert or else. By the end of the 4th century, polytheistic religious practice, which had been widespread in rural Europe, Africa, and parts of the Middle East, went underground to avoid being terrorized by the Roman Empire. St. Augustine's attitude is informative in this respect. In his writings called Confessions, he referenced his failed efforts to seek God in nature. He could not reconcile the Christian view that God is a supreme being of absolute goodness and righteousness with the destructive forces that he witnessed in the creation, those that seemed indifferent or even hostile to human existence. In the conflict between good and evil, a fundamental tenet of the Abrahamic religious lineage was that the dark side of nature, floods, disease, famine, were cast as either the result of demonic forces or of God's wrath. This sort of reasoning helped kick God out of the creation, elevating this deity to a realm removed from the material. Given this bias, pagans, with their simple earth-based theology, one that embraced all aspects of the natural world, both constructive and destructive, were soon branded as evil. What followed were centuries of persecution in various guises, from the burning of witches to the genocide perpetrated against many indigenous peoples, including Native Americans. The assault on paganism was also an assault on the goddess, the feminine, and so on life itself. Most notable of these sad episodes was the burning time, when witches or Wiccans were tortured and murdered on a large scale. Over several centuries, beginning in the so-called Dark Ages, over 100,000 women and children were demonized as followers of witchcraft and subsequently tortured until they confessed, at which point they were often burned. This is a chilling example of what can occur when a religious ideology, in this case medieval, grows alienated from its home and nature, prompting it to define the natural world as wild, mindless, and dangerous. This is a denial of our primal source, the mother, the goddess, the stars. Religion, if it is to be alive and in balance, must fully embrace material existence itself as a manifestation of the divine, rather than driving a wedge between the creator and the creation. The infamous Salem witch trials occurred toward the conclusion of this sad epic. The last known person to be murdered for practicing so-called witchcraft was in Australia in 1747, but it wasn't until 1951 that the last law prohibiting and punishing witchcraft was abolished, this in Great Britain. All of this mayhem was perpetrated in the name of God. It wasn't until 1985 that Wicca, the most prevalent of the pagan belief systems in the West, was officially recognized as a religion in its own right. Today, census surveys indicate that about 250,000, roughly, people are actively practice Wicca in North America, although this number is probably artificially low because many are still reluctant to openly acknowledge this spiritual affiliation. The bloody wake from the burning time still lingers in our collective consciousness. In terms of the number of its adherents in the United States, Wicca ranks right behind Unitarian Universalism. I'm sure you probably appreciate that. In contrast to so-called Western civilization, Eastern religious traditions have been comfortable with pagan ideas. You know, whenever I say the term Western civilization, I think of that interview that a British journalist did with Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, and he asked him, what do you think about Western civilization? And Gandhi said, I think it would be a good idea. Sorry, I digress. But to, again, consider some of these Eastern traditions, Hinduism has a strong polytheistic lineage. Taoism is a deeply nature-based philosophy, more than a religion. But in general, those who ascribe to Eastern religions have not accepted this schism between creator and creation. What all nature-based traditions encourage is to directly experience the divine through the conduit of the natural world. Today, the modus operandi of the nature mystic, if you want to call it that, involves three primary paths. First, we call soulfulness, which is basically a sensory-based contact with the natural world. Paul was sort of talking about that earlier, that alters one's consciousness by diluting the ego and amplifying a feeling of oneness with the creation. Mindfulness, for those of you who practice it, is a close secular cousin of soulfulness. Blending is the other approach, and this involves closely aligning one's physical actions with an aspect or process in nature. A modern and largely derisive term for this is tree hugging. And then finally, there's adoration, which includes ceremonies and rituals that honor and worship the forces of nature as manifestations of the sacred. I often describe this thing, soulfulness, as an extroverted meditation. It involves escaping the formidable boundaries of the ego in order to meld one's awareness, some might say one's soul, with the natural environment. Soulfulness is an alert, meditative state in which one discovers that everything in process in nature is imbued with this ineffable power we call the life force. So, when in a soulful state, one experiences all natural phenomena as alive and sentient. One path to soulfulness is through this process called blending, which amplifies the consciousness that's inherent in the body, what is sometimes called organismic wisdom. To pagans, the body is a sacred aspect of nature and so regarded as a wellspring of the intuitive. Through blending, nature mystics synchronize their physiology and movements to create a shared space with something in the natural world. Prairie grass blowing in the wind, waves crashing on the shore, wind, clouds, trees, whatever it is out there, they seek to blend or dance with that force. Through ceremonies and rituals, whether collective or individual, the nature mystic blends her body energy and physical movements with entities and processes in the natural world. This is the basis, by the way, for full body immersion baptism in Christianity, one of many traditional religious practices first derived from pagan rituals. Now, there is anthropological research suggesting that the most frequent catalyst for mystical experiences, regardless of one's faith tradition, is nature. Put another way, nature is a doorway to mystical communion with the divine, and one that can just as readily occur spontaneously as through conscious effort. Most of us have, by happenstance, walked through, or at least looked through, some of the mystical portals afforded by the natural world. If you've ever been genuinely smitten by a radiant sunset, a rainbow set against a stormy sky, the hiss of snow falling into dark woods at night, or the melodic singing of birds, then a door has been opened to you, even if just a crack, affording you an experience of soulfulness. Most of us assume that these doors, these interludes of awe and wonder, simply lead to an encounter with nature's beauty, and we leave it at that. But there is more within, much more. I'm reminded of a teaching tale from Zen Buddhism about a Zen Buddhist master named Gensha. A novice monk who was studying with Gensha came to him one day and said, out of frustration, said, "Where can I enter Zen?" To which Gensha replied, "Can you hear the babbling brook?" "Yes, I can hear it," the monk answered. Smiling, Gensha replied, "Then enter there." How many times have you paused to listen in the broadest possible sense to the babbling of a brook, the birds in their melodic singing, the shush of a waterfall, or the timeless music of crickets on a warm summer evening? Perhaps in those moments, nature momentarily held you spellbound as it whispered to your soul through the flesh of the creation. Maybe, even if briefly, time slowed, your thoughts went mute. You forgot yourself and your life for a moment, and there was only an ethereal whisper through that opened door. For those who wish to enter the mystery of the creation, who long for this, who want to leave the prison cell of the ego and take flight, nature provides ways. These are not the paths of some human-made religion or pedantic ritual, but rather the uncensored expression of the Creator in material form. Soulfulness, blending, adoration, these are states of being and doing that create and sustain this mystical engagement. And today, behavioral science and a new field called eco-psychology have demonstrated the many benefits of this kind of engagement, from the mental to the physical to the spiritual. Some of you may have heard about something that's now prescribed in Europe and Japan called forest bathing. Forest bathing is a part of the soulfulness process. Now it's been sort of taken into the realm of mental health care, and physicians are prescribing forest bathing for people who are stressed out. Who isn't? We also find that nature interaction has profound effects on psychology and emotional well-being, decreases anxiety, slows time and hurry sickness, reduces stress, increases immunity response. And why are all these things happening when we're in confluence with nature? Because we're going home. So when one's consciousness escapes the illusion of being separate from the rest of nature and embraces this greater reality through direct experience rather than simply through thinking, there is an occurrence of what Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu called primal union, confluence with the creation. So the path to soulfulness is through one's senses, seeing, hearing, feeling, smelling, even tasting. As the renegade psychoanalyst Fritz Perls admonished us, quote, lose your mind and come to your senses. All we need do is tune our senses to the natural world. Then it will find us. It will draw us in. I know I become soulful when I am so smitten by the creation that time and tasks are no more and I harbor no thoughts of what has been or what will be. There's only the here and the now in all its splendor. Once a backpacking companion and I spent many hours standing atop an escarpment that held our base camp in the high Rockies, peering out over a deep, broad alpine valley to the towering spires of rock on the escarpment that rose from its southern flank. Some might consider this a boring exercise in staring at the same thing for hours on end, but when soulful, one sees that there is no such thing as same. Every instant in nature is different, a new note in a symphony of constant transformation. Light and shadow dance forever, painting the topography so that no moment is quite like the one that precedes or follows it. As backcountry people are fond of saying, there's no such thing as hiking the same trail. What the nature mystic senses in the creation, then, is quite simply the face of God. Everywhere she looks, the Creator looks back. Each time a nature mystic brings her eye into contact with the natural realm, she experiences a thou, a living entity, not an it, not a thing. So soulfulness is perceiving the beatific in what most regard as the ordinary, or simply the pleasing and beautiful. Like the aesthetically sensitive person who can absorb the mesmerizing nuances of a song, a painting, or sculpture, the nature mystic senses far more than most. To her, there is no such thing as just clouds or a mere crow or an ordinary tree. Most often, the seeds of nature mysticism sprout during childhood, before we're taught to regard nature as a vast material machine rather than a living, numinous manifestation of the divine. And while this initial awakening often grows dormant amid the cares and woes of adulthood, it does not die. So I invite you to venture down your own memory lane for a moment. What are some of your first recollections of nature? Were they tinged with quiet and wonder? Did you burst forth with delight and awe? Were they tinged with quiet and wonder? Were there moments of recoil and fear or pain? Do you remember what it was like to be in that state of childlike fascination, the kind that comes intuitively from the part of you that still knows where its existential home resides? How did you first behold one of creation's spiritual doors? And did you ever walk any of its ways into the mystery? Almost every person I have ever spoken with has done just that. It is a near universal human experience, and that gives me great hope. It is through the eyes of a child that the nature mystic seeks to see. It is with those sensitive neophyte fingers that she tries to touch the natural world. It is those flesh and wide open fresh and wide open ears that become the portal for listening to the sounds of life in its ceaseless becoming. It is the acute sensory perceptions, innocent wonder, and oceanic consciousness of the child that best describes the state of being that a nature mystic embraces. Is in those moments when the Creator opens the door to our souls and beckons, we decide to enter or not. In closing, I'd like to read a couple of quick musings of those who decided to enter one of those doors. Terry Tempest Williams. What I know in my bones is that I forgot to take time to remember what I know. The world is holy. We are holy. All life is holy. Daily prayers are delivered on the lips of breaking waves, the whisperings of grasses, the shimmering of leaves. And from Albert Schweitzer, the deeper we look into nature, the more we recognize that it is full of life, and the more profoundly we know that all life is a secret and that we are united with all life that is in nature. Man can no longer live his life for himself alone. We realize that all life is valuable and that we are united to this. From this knowledge comes our spiritual relationship with the universe. And finally, from John Milton, even before I could speak, I remember crawling through the blueberry patches in the wild meadows on our hillsides. I quickly discovered nature was filled with spirit. I never saw any separation between spirit and nature. Much later, I discovered our culture taught that there was supposed to be some kind of separation, that God, spirit, and nature were supposed to be divided and different. However, at my early age, it seemed absolutely obvious that the Church of the Earth was the greatest church of all, that the Temple of the Forest was the supreme temple. And when I went to the sanctuary of the mountain, I found Earth's natural altar, the Great Spirit's shrine. Years later, I discovered that this path of going into nature, bonding deeply with it, and seeing spirit within nature, God, Goddess, and Great Spirit, was humanity's most ancient, most primordial path of spiritual cultivation. I went over. Anyway, nature invites us to be found. All we have to do is to open ourselves to it, and we will be found.